decades, I can tell you that, and I don't have to tell you, you would know that, you know, that Cathal Dunn, first of all, a friend of mine served for 40 years at least, a tremendous entertainer, somebody it's a pleasure to know who has absolutely taken the success that he had, well, maybe before this, but definitely in 1979, we have, of course, he made the thing. Now, if I think when we go to Pittsburgh, there's a delay in that, so maybe your wife Kathleen could turn that down, and this way I would be able to welcome welcome my friend Cathal Dunn. How are you, Cathal?
Oh, I'm yeah.
Okay. Well, there's something on the line. We're listening in on a conversation. Okay, this isn't Cathal Dunn, but anyway, just for the crack, let's listen and see if we can hear a little bit of this.
The end of our block is the beach.
Yeah. I remember it well, the end of the block, yeah. A lovely boardwalk too.
I know it.
Yeah. Well, good for you. Oh, you got him. You got him. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right.
So anyway, Arna Collins, I'll put you on to Adrian, and good luck with it.
Oh, you know who that is? Chit-chatting. You know, I thought we got in on some stranger's call. That's Anya. Anya Sheridan, yeah, chatting away to be friends. So, yeah. Now, do we have?
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah, I hope that when you were chatting there, Cathal Dunn, with Anya, that you know you left some bit of news for me, because we could hear that conversation. You know, over the
radio?
It was going on all over the world, you know.
Oh, you're joking.
And you know what I was concerned about? You know, either one of you could be bed-mouthing me any minute, and there wouldn't be a thing that I could do about it, you know.
Oh, boy. That's the beauty of doing home radio, isn't it?
How are things in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
They're pretty good. We've got autumn leaves and all the colors. It's glorious. We're in southwestern Pennsylvania, and blue skies, a bit nippy, but a nice day overall.
Yeah. While it would appear that the entertainment industry around the world has taken a huge, huge crash, that hasn't stopped you from Cathal Dunn being Cathal Dunn. And you have tours lined up, you know, for all of next year, which hopefully you'll be able to, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, because, you know, if it's not just you and your fantastic band, but a lot of people want to look forward. They want to look forward to, to again, live music and so. But I want to start with you, and it was around the time that I met you, though. Let's go to 1979, and the young whippersnapper representing Ireland in the Eurovision Song Contest, and you know, the Eurovision Song Contest, I think most people would agree with it, the Irish songs really didn't feature. Can you bring us back to that theme? Eurovision Song Contest. Every country could, you know, make an entry and be represented. Now,
What it really was it was sort of a pop contest, sort of equivalent to, say, America's Got Talent in a more innocent way at the time. And going back to those countries, including Ireland, most of the countries had one TV station, as we had. And anybody and his mother could write a song and send it in, usually on a cassette, into the TV station. And they had to sift through all the songs in each country, pick out eight, and then we'd be on television. And I was lucky enough that I got in 1979 with Happy Man. And then we went out, great, exciting orchestra. It was watched by everybody. It was like, it was the Super Bowl, really, in those days in each country. And ABBA, for example, won it for Sweden. Celine Dion won it for Austria in 1984. I think that's where she got her break. Right. So it was a big thing. And I sang it in Ireland, like eight of other acts did. And then everybody would vote in, like they'd call in to the station, and the biggest votes won the thing that night. And I won. And that gave me the honor to represent Ireland in Israel, of all countries, because they won it the year before, so they had to host it. It went on to become my first number one in Ireland. My only number one, to be honest with you. Well, because sort of in a similar way to COVID, Adrian, the recession came along in 1979, 80, 81, 82, 83. And Ireland just literally shut down exactly as we were shut down 6 months ago. And I had the choice. I had a degree in music. I could teach for the rest of my life and maybe play in bands or whatever. But I wanted to do more than that. I had a taste of it, you know. And you and I know, like, this game, it's a drug. So I just wanted to try it. And
it's worse than, It's worse than smoking and drinking at the same time. Oh, I got it.
You can sort of give that up. You can sort of give that up, but you can't give the drug of the microphone.
I know.
So I came over, and the first thing I was hit with was the fantastic positivity of America and the energy. And people saying, you know, good luck to you, go for it, what can I do for you? And I love that. And after about a year, I ended up in Pittsburgh, and I stick for, actually it was a weekend I was supposed to come to play, and a friend of mine, George Casey, a comedian, fine comedian, you might know him, he got the call, "We all hate, my mother is dying in Ireland, could you cover for me in Pittsburgh?" So I came up from Chicago for the weekend, loved it, loved the hills and the valleys of Pittsburgh, and loved the people, and I'm still here 30 odd years later.
It's an amazing story, and I know that you have been influenced by one of the great ladies of America in your wife, Kathleen, who's been there. You know, she does everything but put your socks on for you. And it's
Are you talking about Onion, or are you talking about Kathleen?
I envy you. You know, Onion wouldn't put a sock on me if I had to walk out in the snow. But anyway, this is it. Now we're getting too personal. Tell us, though, if you will, about your book. The book is Athenry, and it's an odyssey of sacrifice and survival and love. Now, if we look back on the hundreds of books written about the famine in Ireland, there's no love story there, and most people would assume that with the starvation, with people dying on the side of the road, love, listen, you'd love to be alive, and that'd be the problem.
I know,
probably.
I know.
That'd be the size of it.
This book is a huge love story with epic proportions of Ireland, Australia, America. And it's mainly a big, big love story between Liam and Moira. And it happened, of course, before the famine. And love certainly existed before, during, and after the famine. But in this case, they were lucky enough to meet each other, fall in love, have a child. They were on the landlord's, renting what used to be their land. And they had a son, Tomás. And suddenly the famine hits, and it hits hard, and year after year, and Liam, our hero, was desperate to try and get some food, and just like inspired by the fields of Athenry, he gets caught, shipped over to Australia, and it's the story of Moira's struggle for survival during those awful years, and Liam's banishment, and his determination to come back to her, and that is the story, the love story with the famine and other sort of events as a sort of a context for the book. And I mean, I don't know about you, Adrian, but I didn't give a hoot about history in school, and I only sort of recently started my last 10 years, started learning and loving history. And I was driving 30,000, 40,000 miles a year up to this COVID thing. Wow. And I'm singing The Fields of Athenry almost every night. It's such an iconic, amazing song, has touched the soul of the diaspora, really. And I got the idea, Michael, they have taken you away. That put a human face on the famine for the first time ever, for me, sort of. And I thought it might be an interesting idea to develop that. And I had the start, I had the finish, and through a lot of research, I got the middle part. And I've learned a ton of history through it. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done, to be honest with you, but the most satisfying.
You know, my guest is Cathal Dunn. Cathal, you were mentioning there, you know, about Irish history. And for, I suppose, for a multitude of reasons, Irish history, particularly that, you know, taught in schools, was, you know, the curriculum was very limited, and for some reason, and even when we went on to, you know, to high school, to college, there was a tendency in Ireland, you know, they'd be twice as happy to be writing about European history and world history.
Yeah.
And, you know, for some reasons, plus, of course, not you, because you're only a gossiper compared to me. But in my day, it was very selective. You know, there was the famine.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to bring up the famine because, after all, you know, the survivor guilt was raw at the time. And definitely nobody wanted to bring up, for instance, the partition in Ireland. Because, you know, many family members and friends, they were murdered, they were, you know, never mind Van Diemen's Land, you know, many of them on the run. And I know, you know, when I came here looking around New York, you'd figure, you know, that the businessmen, those who owned bars and restaurants, those, many of them were on the run, and from what I understand, a lot of them wound up in Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania, places like Scranton and Philadelphia.
So
the whole, you know, the notion that we were hanging on to every aspect of Irish history, well, that'd be wrong. And besides, we weren't encouraged. And to add to my misery, although it wasn't misery at all, our history was taught in Irish. So I got up to actually, I didn't understand it that well, but I remember, though, that there was a story in Irish on Brian Boru, but it kind of, the version that I learned there, you know, it was kind of, should I say, off color, and it's not for air. But tell us about, and you have actually impressed us, you know, with the Fields of Athenry, the songs that you've sung. I don't think many people would have even considered, that there was room for love. And when we look back on it, you know, that is such
there was love meant in those days, love of the family, love of their religion, love of their neighbor. It was very, very strong. And so history, unfortunately in Ireland, is written by the winners. And England certainly edited out the famine and their part of the cause, the total cause of the famine. And it was so awful. The Irish sort of repressed it all in their psyche. And it's only now, like when the Irish Americans look back and see the impoverished context where they came from, as getting back to our tours, when I obviously the majority of the people on our tours every year are Irish American, and we bring them back, like the first night we bring them to Bunratty and the folk park there, and they see the cottages, the thatched cottages that they would have come from, and they cry, and it's like a catharsis and an epiphany, and their pride bursts about being Irish more so than ever. And most people, even in Ireland, sort of know very little about the famine, especially why it ended. And that took a lot of my research to find out how and why and what happened in around 1849. But it was a terrible time, but there was hope. And as I said, love represents their religion, their family, and their individual.
Kyle, you mentioned there love of your neighbor. That was a tough one, considering that our neighbors were the ones that were coming in with the hatchet. And
I didn't mean those neighbors. I mean, I meant the Irish.
All right, we just need to straighten that out. We need to straighten that out now, because you know Christian charity can only go so far, and then after that, that's it.
Well,
that's where we draw the line.
I was fascinated when I was doing sort of Googling away on the famine and the convict ships, etc. And I came across a microfilm of an English convict, John Acton Ross, who was shipped over. And I contacted the library in Perth, Australia, and I begged them to go in and put the microfilm on a file for me, which they did. And they sent me over a 125-page journal of this Englishman who wrote a daily journal of his trip from the time they were shipped to the time they arrived. And I got all the facts, all the food, all the conditions, all the weather. There were actually teachers on board that taught the convicts how to read and write to give them a better shot when they got to Australia. Way, way more humane and benign than was the convict or the coffin ships of the Irish going over to America, because, for example, the ship owners were paid 50% up front on departure from England, and they were only paid 50%, the other 50, when the convicts arrived in Australia well and healthy. So I put my fictional character Liam on board this ship, and this Englishman taught him how to read and write and how to write a letter back to Moira. And our hero sort of evolves from an illiterate, strong Irishman into a pretty refined human being. He discovers poetry and music, classical music on the way over. When he gets to Australia, he's a different human being, as we all hope to evolve in our years, you know?
Yeah. You know, to tie that book, and you know, it, first of all, it's a fabulous book, highly recommend it. But we can see your own expertise in composition and your talent, for not only as a singer and a musician and whatever, but you're able to carry your own songs, and they become popular, but for a very good reason, is they're deep. Deep in the sense that, you know, whether it's happiness, sadness, or anywhere in between, the emotion comes through. And by the way, over the last 40 years, if I got just even $1 for every track that I played of your 40 records, you know, you'd owe me a pile of money, but this is not the time to get, you know, to be, that. No, I don't want to get into
it. We can talk once we're off the radio.
Absolutely.
I've been working so hard over the last 6 years, I'm loaded now, Adrian. I can just tell me the amount, I'll write a check. A bouncy one.
Excuse me. That's not good. You could get locked up for coughing in New York City or on this place. Remember the time, of course, when somebody would sneeze anywhere, here, Ireland, or somewhere, and the instant reaction to that would be, God bless you. Bless you. Okay, you sneeze around somebody now and say, would you ever, you know, off.
There's an Olympic track run out of the place. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And if there are any blessings associated with sneezing, I think they're on hold for the moment. Let's come back, though, to your songs, your singing, your music. Now, you didn't catch that from the last shower or from the wind. You grew up in a very musical family.
Yeah. My dad was from Waterford, Gerard Dunn, and he played the accordion and he played the piano. And my mother was in loads of choirs. And when we grew up in just a suburb of Cork, a place called Douglas, the School of Music was nearby. Apparently, when I was, we start school at 4, as you know, in Ireland, it's national school, primary school. And the teacher, Benny Kyla, Mrs. O'Kiley, Mrs. Kyla, she was my first mentor. We did everything through Irish, like you said, all Irish speaking school. And we learned Bodgin Eilimead was the first song I ever learned in Irish. And she played on a small little 8-octave, 8-note little machine. And she was playing a wrong note or something, and it bugged me. And I said, you're wrong, and I'm 4. She said, I suppose you can play it. I said, I can. And I went up, and I apparently corrected her. And she said, I want to see your mother immediately. And Mum came in, and I was expecting big trouble. And she said, look, that fella has a bit of an ear on him. Send him down to the School of Music. Yeah. And I went down, and I started my classical sort of years and years and years at 4. And fortunately for me, because I was useless at any sports, I couldn't kick a football straight, to the shame of my uncle, who was, as you know, like an amazing Irish athlete, hurler and footballer. But that was another story. But thankfully, that first lady spotted a bit of talent in me, and that's how I started. But with the encouragement of Mum and Dad, who were very musical.
You know, and then, of course, you getting your bachelor's from University College Cork. You know, that was, you know, another choice that has been made, because even around that time, people were saying it's great. Music is a great pastime.
Great. Yeah.
The idea, the notion of, you know, playing, performance, well, for that matter, it could be any of the arts, a career was, you know, that would put the hair standing on the back of the necks of parents say, you know.
My mother never got over it. I didn't become a teacher like my father. I know for a fact, like, the money that I owe you for all the radio plays, I bet it now that you never heard the word self-esteem up in Mayo.
No,
you didn't hear What? Who the hell do you think you are? You're going to try and go full time? You must be out of your mind. Go away out of that. And that's from my mother, like, not friends or so. And we were always fighting that in Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, to step out of line a little bit and you're pushed back. But luckily, then when I was in college in Cork, it was the time when Sean O'Riordan was lecturing in Irish music. And his singer for Cúil Tóirí Cúlainn was Sean O'Shea, also from Cork.
Yeah.
And when poor old Sean O'Riordan died at 41, I took over accompanying Sean O'Shea in the radio and TV shows he did and lots of shows. And I met all the leading traditional Irish musicians at the time and the television shows that he hosted. And that started, gave me a tremendous appreciation of traditional Irish music. And, you know, I sort of regret not going into that further as in my career, but it wasn't, you couldn't make any money out of it at the time in the 70s, as you know.
Yeah.
Now it's gone to such a sophisticated level, it's marvelous.
Yeah.
But at the time, it wasn't a way to go. Pop music was the way to go, and I liked it, I have to say, and I still do.
Yeah.
But my favorite of all is classical.
I know. And indeed, for my own choice and enjoyment, you know, for instance, your piano playing, which is superb, you know, playing Strauss waltzes, playing Broadway tunes, it's terrific, and I know that it has to give you, you know, satisfies that need. And you're not against taking that when you go to your concerts too. Yes, the traditional Irish music very much popular, but I think that's one of the features of your act, is that, you know, pretty much like my own program here, you know, it's full of surprises, most of them, you know, not necessarily great. Now, I'm only speaking for myself. But to get an audience and to get their attention when you veer off into an area that's much broader than Irish music, again, when we were growing up, as you know, I'm sure you can attest to, there was a tremendous love of all kinds of music. It was not just Irish music.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, when we came here to the United States, we'd hear more Irish music than we ever did at home.
That's exactly the case with me too. When I was 15 or so, my dad got too busy. He became president of the School of Commerce, or principal, I should say. And he was also the organist at the church in Douglas. And he said, look, he says, you've got to do the weddings and the funerals now. I had 3 days notice. And he said, there's going to be singers coming in, and they're going to be singing Ave Maria, Ave Verum, Panis Angelicus. And I had 3 days to learn those tunes and play the organ. And I was introduced to these wonderful genius composers that way. And then there were these incredibly marvelous Irish sort of tenors and sopranos that I had to accompany. And, you know, looking back now, I mean, they were world class. But, of course, they were working in Ford's factory and whatever, Dunlop's in Cork, and they were just, like you said, it was a pastime. They made a few shillings out of it. But these guys, I mean, honest to God, Adrian, some of these guys were as good as Andre Bocelli, but they didn't know it. They went to the pub on a Saturday night, sang a few songs, and then sang at the weddings and the funerals. So then, after that, then I started going to sort of fancy parties for people, you know, with big shops in Cork. And I started accompanying, you know, when the sing song starts after the dinner. And for some weird reason, when the guy got up and sang Memories or whatever, he'd start in C and then he'd go up to D flat and then he might go down to B and sort of up to C again.
Yeah.
But, you know, slightly, I was able to follow him and so nobody noticed that he was changing, he was out of key. But I was able to play in every key, so he knew it. So after a while, these guys started booking me specifically because I made them sound good, you know.
And someone, someone can call it on, you know, to an age-old phenomenon. You know, if you know, if the bar, the restaurant, if it's moving along and the money is coming through the door. And people, you know, those are, you know, who'd say, the music was great terrific. However, if the place was empty on a snowy night and nobody was able to even slip or slide through the door, they say, geez, the band was awful.
The vibe of the crowd makes the thing, and that's what we're all missing right now. That sort of feel live music, and it'll come back. I'm confident soon there'll be a rapid trace test thing that, you know, for example, I'm really hoping that there'll be, you know, a test, say a check-in at the airport, and by the time you get to the gate, you're told yay or nay, and we all get on board confident that nobody has it on the plane, and another quick test in Ireland, and that's coming. I was reading there on the Cork Examiner last week that the teachers, they have a 15-minute antigen test in the schools now in Ireland.
Yeah.
It's not as positive as the stronger official COVID test, but it's very, very good, and that's a 15-minute. I mean, we're getting there.
I want to come back to your book. First of all, it is fantastic, and anything like the reviews are incredible. You know, done without there. You know, Malachy McCourt. You know, that's what I suggest, but you didn't. I didn't say that again. You know, it could be, but I heard that to it. Oh, no, Malachy is all right. You know, Malachy is, by his own admission, you know, he considers himself to be, you know, in the waiting room. And while he was in the waiting room, waiting for the next big step, he wrote a book himself, and it's called Death Need Not Be Fatal, you know.
Yeah, so, I know the book.
That's an aside.
Malachy was very, very kind and generous, and he gave me a nice review, and I was delighted, as you did, as many others did. I got a call from Noel Pearson, the movie director in Ireland, last week. He read it, he loved it, and he said, look, he says, I hate to tell you, but every famine movie so far has flopped. And I'd never get investors. But he said, look, I know a pretty good literary agent in Dublin. I'll give it to her the next time I see her. So even though it was a bit disappointing, I might get a publishing deal in Ireland, which would be great.
Even if it doesn't get that far, it's something that I have a feeling you know, will really take off in America because it's different. It is, you know, again, a depressing historical fact. The Irish famine, the great hunger, is indeed something that has and will continue to have an impact not just in Ireland but the Irish diaspora, including those in America. This book, I can only tell you, and you know, most books I read, you know, I take into Snarling Night House, the in-house, and I kind of, you know, go through. But this one, I actually took out of the bathroom and I sat down and I've been reading it ever since.
Out of the bathroom. Out of the bathroom. Stuff for Adrian Flannery.
No, I still have Malachi's book in there, and I figured I'd leave it. How do we get the book?
Well, first of all, it's $15 plus shipping and handling. If you go to my website, cahaldunne.com, CAHALDUNNE.com. It's also available on Amazon Kindle for a download for $8.99. And, you know, that's how it's going. It's going very, very well, actually, Adrian. It's out now 3 weeks, and I ordered 1,000. And I'm just coming up to about 500 out the door. And there's about 200 downloads on Kindle. So for a start, it's working.
I sincerely
appreciate your talking about it today. It's a very positive love story, affirmation of hope and all the good stuff that the Irish had. We were told for 800 years we were stupid, but we just, the penal laws that came in the 17th century when we sided with Charles Stuart against William of Orange at the Battle of the Boyne, and the Irish sort of lost, sadly, the Irish side lost, and the English were terrified that the Catholics in Ireland would ally once again with the Catholics in France. So they took everything from the Irish, the land, the language, the religion, every single thing. And that's what led to the famine, because by the time the famine hit, we were just emasculated totally by the British policies of laissez-faire, etc. And we just couldn't fight it. And yes, 100 years later, 200 years, look at the Irish all over the world now.
175.
Incredibly. My nieces and nephews got great jobs in IT and pharma in Ireland. No need to emigrate anymore. Look at the rise and rise and rise of Ireland. It's marvelous. And the maturity of the Irish right now is in Ireland is marvelous as well.
We came from
that awful time, the famine, and we were given a shot and we took it. And look at us now.
My good friend through the decades, Cathal Dunn, I'm delighted with the book myself, and now some of it, there is a chapter there that I've read 3 times in a row. But then again, I'm kind of a slow reader, and I only absorb so much at a time. It's a great book. Good luck with the book. My best to Kathleen and to your son, and. Good luck with that. I know it's going to do extremely well. That is, to reach and get information, log on to Cathal Dunne's website, CAHALDUNNE.com. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Thank you.
You're a happy man, and that's how we want to leave it. Okay.
Okay. Adrian, God bless. Thank you, Adrian. Thank you, Anya.
Very welcome indeed. York, Athenry, friends. Indeed, it's a happy story from a period where there was very little happiness. I want to thank you and Soda Sonia Sheridan for spending the time with us this well as morning in New York. It's heading now for noontime. The sun shining brightly. And again, thank you for listening. And keep the chin up. That's the best any of us could do. There are better days ahead. Maybe we can be all happy then.